This presidential election offers American voters a clear choice on the issues of health care. Do they like the policies of the Biden-Harris administration, or do they want to return to the Trump-era approach?
I think what you see with Vice President Harris is a candidate who is committed to protecting women's freedom, to protecting the women's right to choose.
We are going to dive right into the healthcare policy debate with our accomplished guests. Andrea Dukes is the Vice President of Health Policy at the Center for American Progress. Wayne Weingarten is the Senior Fellow and the Director of the Center for Medical Economics and Innovation at Pacific Research Institute.
The problem with most global climate change policies that we're implementing now is that they're not effective, and that the cost in terms of reduced reliability of the grid, which is a growing problem, that especially as we start moving towards some of these mandates that the Biden administration has put into place, it's very disconcerting.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Andrea Dukes, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare. Let's start with the biggest healthcare issue of all right now, abortion. A Gallup poll found a record high 32% of voters said they'll only vote for candidates for major offices who share their position on abortion. And yet 85% of Americans believe abortion should be legal in at least certain circumstances. What do you and others on the progressive side want to see Kamala Harris do on the abortion issue if she's elected?
Yeah, I mean, first, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you today. But to answer your question, I mean, I think what we're hoping for is that she will deliver on exactly what she says she's going to do, which is work to, you know, restore access to abortion as the law of the land in this country. I mean, I think what you see with Vice President Harris is a candidate who is committed to protecting women's freedom, to protecting the women's right to choose, and to advancing back toward a country where access to the full spectrum of reproductive care is the norm and not the exception. So that's how I would answer that question.
How about the filibuster? Is that something that you'd be supportive of her undertaking?
I mean, I think there are a number of structural impediments that keep us from making progress toward common sense solutions that enjoy robust support, as you just described, right? The vast majority of people are supportive of having access to abortion. So, yeah, I mean, Any attempt to make it easier to pass legislation that is reflective of the will of the people is something that we support, yes.
Well, Andrea, former President Trump has disavowed the conservative blueprint that we call Project 2025, but you and your colleagues aren't letting him off the hook.
Yeah.
Explain to our listeners, how do you see Project 2025 and what it prescribes for the American healthcare system?
Well, former President Trump disavows a lot of things he then supports. So I would say, you know, we view that sort of distancing as a distinction without a difference. It's very, very clear what the intent of Project 2025 was. You can just look to the report's authors to get a sense of how close they are to the former president. And you can look to his own closeness with folks at the Heritage Foundation to get an indication of exactly how intertwined that document is and that agenda is with what you would expect to see another Trump administration looking like. But I mean, I think, again, what's laid out in that document is an antithetical vision of America. It is a far right, you know, authoritarian manifesto that would completely redo our system of checks and balances in service of advancing the interests of a small minority of people who want to take their will and insert it on the entire American public. I think it's not a surprise that former President Trump has tried to distance himself as much as possible from what's laid out in Project 2025, because the proposals are wildly unpopular. The public has seen these. They do not look like what they see. So it's, you know, not surprising at all that you would want to see an attempt to run from that. But, you know, what's in there, we were just talking about abortion, I think it's pretty consistent with where you see a future Trump administration going. I mean, look at what he talks about. He's thrilled that he installed justices on the Supreme Court that overturned Roe v. Wade, right? And what do you see in Project 2025? Even more attempts to effectively outlaw abortion, right? So it's very, very consistent with where he seems to be wanting to go as a political candidate.
Andrea, former President Trump has said he has sort of, quote, concepts of a plan to replace the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. His running mate, J.D. Vance, has added some more detail. He said they want to group chronically ill patients in health insurance pools based on their elevated risk. What would the results of such an action be?
It's a pretty disastrous health policy. Like much of what you see in the Trump-Vance agenda, it is a hearkening to the past, going back to systems that don't work or that service just a small number of Americans. I think many voters forget what the world was like before the Affordable Care Act. It's sort of amazing how much that bill reshaped the entire American healthcare system, right? Just completely fundamentally changed what people expect from the healthcare system. But all we need to do is like look. It's not even that old, right? It's 14 years old. But all we need to do is look pre-2010 to get a glimpse at how ineffective a tool like a high-risk pool is. So how does insurance work? Everybody buys into a system, risk gets spread out, right? Premiums are kept relatively low so that when people need to use coverage, they get really sick, they get cancer, they get into an accident, right? There's enough money in the pool to pay for those kinds of services without effectively breaking that bank. The plan to separate chronically ill people into high risk pools completely upends the notion of insurance, right? Those folks would be in their own pool with very, very, very high healthcare expenses. States tried to do this before the ACA. They had a very, 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 very difficult time doing it. It's very expensive to finance those pools. They're very volatile. You can only, because their expenses don't just magically go away, you just move them into their own pool, right? Mm-hmm. You run out of the money that gets allocated toward those risk pools very quickly. And you can't finance them necessarily on premiums alone because, again, the expenses are so high, right? It would effectively be unaffordable unless you really heavily subsidize enrollment in such a risk pool. So what you would probably see, again, is what we saw in the past, right? Which is enrollment would be capped. There'd need to be really, really like a fine-tooth comb that goes through to decide whether or not people even qualify because maybe they're too expensive. So I think it's just a throwback to the wild, wild west that we had for folks who didn't have job-based coverage, right? Or public coverage pre-ACA. It's a plan that doesn't work. It's a plan that we as a nation, right, that signed into law, or we got to a place where we had a landmark health reform, the Affordable Care Act, to get us out of that past. So it would be great to not go back to it.
Well, Andrea, Kamala Harris previously backed a single payer health insurance system that we call generally Medicare for All. But now her campaign says that she's focusing, this is a quote, on common sense solutions for the sake of progress. I'm curious, do you feel abandoned by this move? And what will her approach be to dealing with very expensive healthcare costs?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think not at all. From my perspective, I think where the campaign is where a lot of America is, right? By and large, people are happy with the insurance, the particular insurance product they have. I mean, there are certainly issues with affordability. Mm-hmm. Deductibles are very high, right? Healthcare prices are really high, which relate to how much you're paying, but are somewhat separate issue than what goes into out-of-pocket expenses. But I think, you know, where folks are is they're frustrated by how much they're paying, right? So for the majority of people, right, we now have a record low on insurance rate. Whether you get coverage through your job, whether you get it through the ACA marketplace, right, sometimes it can be really expensive to use if your deductible is high. Because the healthcare system has changed so much in the last 20 years, and you've now got these really dominant players, very large healthcare systems that charge very, very, very high prices. You're also sort of in a situation where often people don't know how much they're going to be expected to pay when they go to receive care. They walk out the door with an exceedingly high medical bill that they can't afford to pay. And they feel cheated, which makes sense, right? I've got this insurance plan I'm paying a lot of money for, and now I've got these astronomical medical bills. This isn't fair. And they're right? So it's been really heartening and wonderful to see the administration, the current administration, focus so much on trying to tackle medical debt, trying to make, you know, medical debt as a concept sort of irrelevant. It's been great to see, like, to see action. I was just at an event today celebrating the attempts to wipe medical debt off of credit reports and to really crack down on nonprofit hospitals who are required to offer financial assistance policies but don't. You know, so I think progress in that direction is what people want. People also want to see the prices of prescription drugs come down. So I think building off of the remarkable progress that we've been able to see through the Inflation Reduction Act, and in terms of lowering out-of-pocket expenses on prescription drugs and Medicare, is something that folks are very supportive of. And Vice President Harris's plan to take those and extend those to the commercial market and outside of Medicare, I think, is important and popular. So I think looking for ways to make progress, right, to actually address the pain and pressure points that people are feeling, which is what's coming out of their pocketbook, right? I think makes a lot of sense.
Andrea, let's talk a little bit about private equity, which is playing a bigger role in healthcare, and the consequences are becoming clear. I think we're reading about hospital bankruptcies, Steward and Prospect and others, and patients really are left to their own devices to deal with the mess. The vice president has little to say about the entire controversy. CAP has referred to the rise of private equity as really a looming crisis. What would you like her stand to be in this area?
Yeah, you know, I think what I would like to see, and I'm going to actually zoom out and say, over the past couple of years, the FTC, right, under the Biden-Harris administration, has taken a pretty active role in trying to unpack and address the role of both consolidation, but also private equity, right, in different markets, including healthcare. So I think, you know, continuing to bring strong scrutiny into what's going on within private equity markets generally, but especially with respect to healthcare, is something that we would expect to continue and hope to see continued. As you mentioned, we do describe this as a looming crisis. It certainly feels that way. There are specialties that are becoming, you know, really sort of getting gobbled up by private equity practices or private equity investors. And in part, this is a result, right, of concentrated market power, right? The bigger the your competitor gets, if you're a sole practitioner, right, like you're a family doc running your own practice, it becomes harder and harder to compete when the other folks in town are giant conglomerates, right? So you look to other sources of capital, and private equity becomes that source of capital, right? So they're coming in to fill the void in markets that are really heavily concentrated. So another thing, again, that we would expect to see is a continued strong regulatory stance and posture from you know, the nation's competition watchdogs. So it's been great, again, to see the joint efforts by the FTC, DOJ, and HHS to really try to go after this. But again, to your point, I think what I would like and expect to see is much more scrutiny on private equity investments in the healthcare system.
Andrea, you referenced the issue of medical debt and what a hot topic that has come to be. I think surprise billing is right up there with it. It certainly contributes to it. But I think on a consumer level, that's definitely one that really sparks ire in the American people. What specific proposals are on the table do you think that we could expect the vice president to lean into in these areas if she wins?
Well, I think with respect to medical debt, she's talked about, right, the desire to effectively wipe that out, right, to do whatever she can to remove medical debt from I'd like to see it sort of removed from the lexicon, right? Like, what a concept. Why is medical debt even something we accept in this country? So I think, you know, she's talked about debt relief proposals. With respect to surprise billing, I mean, I think we see I would expect continued attempts to really make that a reality, right? And to push back against, I mean, I'm sure you and your audience know that it's been sort of a challenging to watch, like the arbitration that's happened primarily financed by private equity practices that have brought prices up in some cases. So I think, again, additional scrutiny to how that kind of process applies would be something that I would expect to see.
Now we turn to an opposite view. Our guest is Wayne Weingarten, Senior Fellow and Director for the Center of Medical Economics and Innovation at the Pacific Research Institute. Wayne, PRI has stated that patients are not in control of their healthcare system and that we suffer from an opaque and complex pricing structure that harms patients. What would you like to see the next president do?
I would love to see the next president make some reforms that actually, like you were saying, starts to put patients back in charge, starts taking care of some of the pricing system kind of issues we have, specifically with drugs. What we really need to do is get rid of a lot of the intermediaries that are, as opposed to bringing these patients together with the providers, is actually making it more difficult, more costly. So what we really need to do is reform the pricing system and reform kind of who's in control of kind of that doctor-patient relationship.
Well, former President Donald Trump recently said that his administration would pay for in vitro fertilization treatments or would force insurance companies to cover them. But PRI has stated that this would be the wrong thing to do. Really curious, why did you take that stand on this particular procedure?
Well, I think we need to, you know, obviously PRI were scholars and different scholars are going to have different opinions. From my position, it's more of a mandate issue. I mean, to me, in vitro fertilization is something, it is very important and the government shouldn't be involved in that at all. So it's between the doctor and the patient in terms of deciding that. So obviously it should be legal. It should be something that people have the option to do, and we need to keep the government out of it. And we need to allow patients, to people who are seeking treatment, to actually have access to the treatments that they need, regardless of what it is. That's the doctor and the patient. So I think that's really important that we don't have the government dictating those terms.
Right. But this was about paying for it. And it sounded like the position was that not whether it could be legal or not, but that insurance companies should pay for it. Did you take a position on that as well?
Well, again, speaking for myself, not for PRI, the important issue is not to mandate it, so that we need some insurance absolutely are going to cover it because people demand it and people want that. But part of the problem that we're seeing with the ACA is that there are so many different mandates of different types of coverage that it's harder and harder for people to get the insurance that's appropriate for them, let alone the fact that our insurance isn't actually providing that key insurance benefit that we need. Right. If health insurance was doing what it was supposed to do, it wouldn't be covering first dollar payments of when you go to a checkup. And that's not a financial risk. What we really need is health insurance to be there for in vitro fertilization. Right. When you actually have a costly medical procedure that's an actual risk, that's where insurance is supposed to come into play. That's what we're actually missing. But the best way to get that type of coverage is to reduce the mandates and allow insurance companies to be competing for enrollees by providing that best coverage. We don't have that. And that's the system we really want to start moving toward. And that's but the problem with mandates is that it makes it that much harder for insurance companies to actually tailor plans to the way that people need it.
Vice President Harris said she wants to preserve President Joe Biden's enhanced Obamacare subsidy. Now, those subsidies are scheduled to end next year. Why do you believe this would be a bad move?
Well, I think if we take a step back, we have to recognize that the subsidies are very costly from a budget perspective. So we're spending a lot of money and we're not getting that much for the money we're spending. So we're creating, a much higher costing insurance product. And you also have to remember that most of the people that the ACA has, you know, in terms of insured, it's through Medicaid, right? About 17 million of the 19 million people who have gained coverage from the ACA is because of expanded Medicaid. So the subsidies, again, you're talking about $20,000-$30,000 of spending for each one of these plans, and you're not providing high quality kind of health coverage. And so that's really the problem, is that we're spending a lot of money and not getting a lot out of it. And so that becomes destructive. It's harmful to the economy. It's going to start actually impacting the deficit, which could have negative consequences on interest rates, you know, and then it snowballs from there. What we really need to do is actually improve on kind of that insurance product that we have, not through the ACA kind of subsidies, which is really just doubling down on policies that just haven't been working. So I think that's the important reform we need to focus on.
We could have a lot of debates about all of these things, but I'm going to move on to another topic. And again, we're really paying attention to what the candidates are saying. And Kamala Harris says that she's going to lower costs for American families by cracking down on price gouging by corporations that reap excessive benefits. From your point of view, how are such actions harmful if that comes to pass?
Well, you know, we can talk about this in a lot of ways. We're talking about the price gouging that she's alleging in grocery stores, or we're talking about price gouging. You know, she's leveled that accusation across the board. And that accusation is typically being leveled because there's been some sort of government failure, not a failure on the kind of the private sector side. So let's take drugs, for instance. Right? We have problems that we need to address in terms of how does the patent system work. We could absolutely improve that. But the bottom line is that the cost of capital for developing a medicine, right? You're talking about 10 to 15 years, an incredible amount of risk, right? Very few medicines that begin actually get to the place where it's available to patients, let alone that it becomes a lot of sales. And you're spending $2.6 billion with post-marketing studies you're spending on average, $2.9 billion. So this is an incredibly long, risky process. And it's incredibly important to recognize that it is the private companies who are providing the lion's share of the money and the lion's share of the research. So you're talking about $100 billion per year the private sector puts into drug development, the entire kind of federal funds going into just broad research overall is only about $20, $30, $40 billion. So you're talking about a lot more money being spent by the private sector, and the private sector is better at commercializing medicine. Why do I go through all that? You have a very short period of time to recoup $2.9 billion. And that's, you know, and that's just the finances behind it. So what we actually need, again, going back to our insurance discussion, is we need a better insurance arrangement to cover that. But that way we actually get the new treatments. And we always focus on affordability, which is incredibly important. Right. But we also have to focus on there's tens of millions of patients living with diseases with inadequate treatments, with no treatments. Right? Alzheimer's, muscular dystrophy, all of these conditions need new therapies. And we're not going to get those new therapies without kind of that covering that cost of capital. So bringing it back to your original question, price gouging. She's actually talking about imposing price controls. That's the solution to the price gouging. And that puts at risk all of this development that's brought us these fantastic drugs. We can now, you know, help people with obesity. You know, we can help all sorts of cancers. We need that process to continue. And accusations of price gouging and price controls really disrupts that. And what the real issue is, how do we get better insurance, not these accusations of price gouging?
When former President Trump has stated that he has no connection to the conservative initiative called Project 2025 from the Heritage Foundation, and many now view it as a mistake to have these ideas publicized. Yet Project 2025 states that healthcare reform should be market-based. Do you feel aligned with the many perspectives in the Project 2025 document?
Well, I haven't read Project 2025, so I can't tell you if I agree with it.
It's only a concept.
in concept, I do think we need to put patients in control. And I think that's what we're talking about. That's one of the things. I think if you think of the average employer plan, right, Kaiser Family Foundation, we're spending about $25,000 per family. for employer plans. It comes some from the employee. Most of that's contributed by the employer. So can you imagine if we had $25,000, or call it $20,000, because $5,000 comes from the employee, $20,000 to put into a health savings account that could go toward doctor visits, that can go towards, you know, paying for catastrophic insurance. There's all sorts of amazing kind of innovations that we could incentivize, where we would actually have the patient making decisions of who do I want to see, who's my doctor. And you have doctors and healthcare clinics who are actually trying to see how can we serve the patient, not how can we serve the insurance company. And so I think that they can collapse the kind of the system where patients and doctors are better connected and patients are controlling the reason. All sorts of innovations, we're going to get better healthcare. And you know, if we think about the healthcare issue as we have a quality of care issue, we have an insurance issue, and we have an issue of income, right? But that type of patient-centric care can help get those first two goals, you know, getting better quality of care and putting that patient in charge and getting better insurance out of it. And then the government's role is then, how do we provide that safety net? How do we ensure that people who don't have enough income to buy insurance can actually participate in that private market? But what we've done is we keep collapsing that into this Medicare for all discussion, which is really just focusing on that one third of the problem. And it actually does a really bad job of trying to address that one third of the problem. And so I think when you're talking about patient care, what you're trying to do is expand it, trying to better identify what the issues are and come up with solutions to each one of those problems.
Well, I know, moving away from health insurance for a moment, that you've written about an issue that is a concern, I think, to all of us here, that global climate change is a really critical problem. Former President Trump has rolled back more than 125 rules and policies that were meant to protect the environment and to lower planet warming emissions. So when we look at the upcoming elections, if a voter is concerned about climate and maybe particularly its effect on health, who should they vote for? Why should they vote for Trump or for the Democratic candidate? And then tell us why.
Well, I would say this. I'm certainly not going to advocate for either one. To me, the issue with climate change, and it's an incredibly important issue, but our problem is that the technology isn't there. And so what we really need to do is incentivize innovation. And I think we need to do it technologically neutral. We don't know yet which technology is going to actually sustainably address the problems that we have. And so to the extent that we could provide really broad-based incentives for innovation, not choosing, oh, we want to incentivize wind or solar or whatever the technology is. We want to, so take tax breaks, where a company that develops a technology that has much lower emissions or zero emissions, whatever the benchmarks are, that they can get profits tax-free in order to incentivize research money to go into that area. When it kind of raise the relative return for people who are investing in these low emission technologies, whatever it is, whether it's natural gas, nuclear, solar, batteries, hydrogen. I mean, I think we need to keep a very broad perspective, not pick winners or losers, but to the extent that we can change the relative returns from people for investing in that type of innovation, we could incentivize the kind of development of the new technologies that we need. The problem with most global climate change policies that we're implementing now is that they're not effective, and that the cost in terms of reduced reliability of the grid, which is a growing problem, that especially as we start moving towards some of these mandates that the Biden administration has put into place, it's very disconcerting that we're going to lose that baseload power and we're not going to have a reliable replacement. And so then all of a sudden, power outages are going to be occurring. And so, you know, that could be particularly troubling on a hot day or a cold day. You know, we've seen that in Texas several years ago. So we really need to focus on innovation, not kind of these technologies that aren't going to get us there.
When private equity is looming large in healthcare, and we've seen some real disastrous issues with Prospect Medical and Steward Hospital, what's the Steward Health. What's your view of the regulatory requirement that should be placed on some of these institutions where real harm is being caused to patients?
Well, I think what you just said in terms of focusing on patients, I think when that's the key kind of we need to be kind of considering. And, you know, to the extent that the private equity is coming in and coming up with new ways of delivering care, focusing on value-based care, getting away from fee-for-service models or, you know, experimenting with new models, all of that could be very beneficial. But, you know, the ultimate arbiter in all of these is got to be patient care, because if you think about how so much of our economy has evolved and changed compared to like 50 years ago, right? In terms of just kind of communications, a telephone, you know, I gave my kids one of the, you know, the old style rotary phones. They had no idea what to do with it. But, you know, cell phones are very, you know, ubiquitous. They know exactly what to do with that. Healthcare is still the way we're delivering it. From 50 years ago, it would be very familiar. You wouldn't be confused when you walked into a doctor's office. And that's part of the problem. So, and the reason I bring that up is because it's a careful balance. To the extent that the private equity money can incentivize those types of changes and innovations, that's fantastic. But we have a very convoluted system. We have a system where middlemen drive the market process, not the patients, not the doctors. And so we need to make sure that all of these changes, in order to the benefit of patients, improving the patient experience, not something that's playing off of some of the kind of inefficiencies and the opacity that we have in the market that are just going to make things worse. So we've got to kind of walk that careful balance. But again, the ultimate arbiter is, how does this improve outcomes for patients?
Thank you to our guests, Wayne Rheingarten with Pacific Research Institute and Andrea Dukas with the Center for American Progress. Most importantly, everybody remember to vote on or before November 5th. And a few other reminders, be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube, find us on Facebook and X with our account name CHC Radio. And as always, you can go online to chcradio.com to sign up for email updates. And please share your thoughts and your comments about this program. Thank you all for joining us today. This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.